Ready to proceed?
May it please the court, this is an appeal, pardon me, Your Honor, I have a slight cold, but this is an appeal from the Chancery Court evaluation or award in a merger action where the limited partners, two limited partners, were merged out for no reason. And as I, of course, argue in my brief, really for monetary gain. And the court held the trial, and on the third day of trial, one of the partners, Kay Ryan, settled her claim. I did not, and we proceeded to trial, and then eventually a briefing, of course, and then the vice chancellor issued an opinion. I don't agree, of course, but we're not appealing or contesting the evaluation per se. Those would be factual issues. Do you believe their expert or my expert? And I don't believe that the court would reverse a factual finding. So we're not really arguing that the evaluation by the vice chancellor was an error. I mean, I don't believe it was correct, but we're not arguing it was an error. The issue really is centers around a precedent by then Vice Chancellor Jacobs in a case called Cole versus Kershaw, which was the same exact situation. There was a merger by the other partners of a limited partner, although in that case there was plenty of reason for doing so. And in fact, as Vice Chancellor Jacobs found, if they had not done so, the partnership would not have survived because the partner merged out was not cooperating, refused to return calls, was not signing loan documents necessary, and not paying his capital contribution, and so forth and so on. That is totally not the case here in any way, shape, or form, nor is there any indication of that.
But the partners in Cole, there was no showing that they lost any of their original capital investment. Is that right?
The partners that remained, the remaining right. partners, no, they didn't lose any of their investment, nor did the partners in this case, of course. In this case, they're going to be making a lot of money based on the rental of the property for 10 years. Of course, the 10 years will be up in a couple of years, but no, I'm sure they'll be able to re-rent it or maybe renew it. I don't know. That's not part of really the issue. We don't know that yet.
But in terms of the capital investment, the value, if you're not contesting the valuation, everyone's valuation is less than their capital contribution. Is that correct or not?
Well, I understand what you're saying. What you're saying is that if you're actually evaluating this way, then their valuation is less also. And theoretically, of course, Your Honor is correct. In practical terms, however, they're still there. And they will reap the benefit of something like $18 million in the future of, well, up to this, for this particular lease, of rent. At that point, they actually received something like $887,000 of income that was not taken into account because some of it was after the merger. Some of it was before the merger. So if you look right there at that moment of the merger, yes, in theory, everybody lost money because at that particular moment, the value was less than what they had invested. But in the next 10 years or the next 8 years, 9 years, they were going to gain much, much more than that because they still owned it. So that's what just Vice Chancellor Jacobs, I mean, the same would have been true in Call versus Kershaw because in Call versus Kershaw, although the court doesn't discuss it, I assume that the other partner's share was also less at that particular moment. But as Vice Chancellor Jacobs noted, they're going to get the benefit of this investment. They were getting the benefit of Call's investment. They were not losing any of their money in the sense that money was taken away from them, just like Call was. I mean, his share was taken away. And he said minimal fairness requires that Call at least recoup what he has invested. And that's our argument. I mean, if minimal fairness applied in Cole, minimal fairness should apply in this case. I mean, it's hard to see how our Vice Chancellor Jacobs could say minimal fairness requires that I increase the interest to 14% so that Cole will get at least, I think it was $82,000, $85,000 rather than $72,000 that he would have gotten based on the valuation. And minimal fairness does not require that in this case.
So you are challenging the valuation.
Yes, I am challenging the valuation. I never said that I wasn't. I just said that I've not presented this as an argument for Your Honor to say the court erred in evaluating it, because it's a factual issue. Who do you believe, our expert? Do you believe their expert? You know, how do you do it? Our expert valued it much, much higher than what was awarded. But who do you believe is a question for the trial judge, not for this court. So I'm going to ask this court to reverse on the evaluation. I'm asking this court to reverse on the inadequacy of the award.
Well, how can we do that without rejecting the valuation?
Well, if minimal fairness requires that the award, at least the investment, be returned, that in Cole, the minimal fairness should apply the same way in this case.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by the phrase minimal fairness. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah. Vice Chancellor Jacobs, when he cited Cole, decided that Cole was only entitled to based on values and based on offsets and so forth and so on, was only entitled to $72,000. So he then said, if I give him whatever interest he was going to give, he'll only get $72,000, and I don't believe that's fair. I believe he should at least be required to get back his capital investment. And he used the phrase, minimal fairness requires that. I mean, I can read the exact quote, if Your Honor wants. But, and to do that, he increased the interest to 14.5%. So that, therefore, the total amount that Cole got equaled his initial investment. And he said, he had that phrase that says middle.
Okay, I see it. And I take it by that he meant, Jacobs meant, and Cole anyway, the original investment.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the simplicity of my argument, frankly. I mean, it just seems to me that if one vice chancellor said this is equitable, then if the vice chancellor in this case was going to disagree with that, he should at least would have an obligation to give us some reason why he shouldn't follow that precedent. I mean, how can one be equitable one judge says it's inequitable, another judge says it's equitable, and that's the simplicity.
I'm having a little bit of trouble following this. Are you suggesting that when there's a valuation made that there is some equitable or legal obligation to come up with a number that at least equals the partner's investment?
Maybe not in every single case, but if not, then I think that the court has an obligation to explain why they should, what factors there are that would preclude the return of the initial investment, applying this precedent of Call versus Kershaw.
Well, the Vice Chancellor here attempt to do that by accounting for the capital contribution that Tom did not make in 1997, setting that off against the value of the original investment.
Yeah, and we're not contesting that either. I mean, we agreed that there should have been a set off for the lack of the contribution or a deficit in the contribution. We're not contesting the fact that that was a proper thing to do. If the court does not accept my argument of minimal fairness or my precedent of Call versus Kershaw, then our other argument is based not on that, not on the capital contribution deficiency, but on the Westward loan and on the expansion value. And then, of course, we have some other arguments also. But if you were to accept the minimal fairness argument, really, that would be the end of the argument, because once you say, well, we're giving him back his capital contribution in as was done in Cole, then the other things have no bearing, because once he gets back their capital contribution, that'd be the end of it, if I'm making myself clear. But if the court does not accept that argument, then Westwood, I mean, first of all, there was some value. There should have been some value in the expansion potential, which I won't dwell on that very long because I think my brief speaks on it, and it's not that complicated, but or that the court may or may not agree with me. But Westwood is frankly, I mean, I don't want to say criminal, but it just strikes you as being completely unfair. I mean, in Westwood, there was a loan that was written off in 96 and put back, and when the merger occurred in 2001, it did not exist. By definition, it was forgiven. It was written off. They had gotten their money by taking an illegal contribution, tax deduction, illegal because, first of all, it was not uncollectible. It was clearly collectible. And second of all, because it was related entities, and everybody agreed that it was improper.
Does the record reflect whether amended tax returns were filed?
No amended tax returns ever been filed as far as I mean, I think there was discussion of that if they got this money, they would be filing something maybe, but nothing had ever been filed, to my knowledge, other than the fact that they put it back on the books. To my knowledge, there's nothing in the record that says that amended tax return was filed. Mr. Wiener can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think so.
Now, the accounting principles, when loans are forgiven by a related party, it's a capital contribution considered by accountants. Is that in the record?
Yes. Both accountants said that it was forgiven. In fact, one accountant said you can't have it both ways. I mean, it's a non sequitur type of thing. I mean, if it's written off, it's got to be forgiven. That's the only way you can do it.
Okay. But why isn't it a wash either way, in the sense that if two partners forgive the loan that they made and thereby make an additional contribution that Tom did not make, how is that any different from restoring the debt and reducing the ultimate value of what would be distributed if there was a liquidation? But why isn't it a wash?
Well, it's not a wash because they made a decision to write this off in 1996. They got at least $406,000 of tax deduction. They actually got more than that, the accountant testified, but that was the minimum they got. The 406 was stipulated to, but could have been as much as maybe 500 or more. They each got like $203,000 when it was stipulated. They were only owed, according to what their own calculations were, what they asked for in their briefing down below, $283,000. They got $406,000 from the government illegally. So,
all right. Well, it's not your contention, is it, that the trust is entitled to share in that?
No, the trust is not entitled to share in it, but once they made a determination to write it off, And did not choose to call it in. I mean, they intentionally said, as I think Joe Capano testified, what doesn't make any sense for me to pay myself so I can pay myself, you know, goes from one pocket to the other. They made that decision. Once they made that decision, and once Chancery Court says, we look at the timetable where the merger occurs, because that's why they refused the expansion argument. That's why the Vice Chancellor said no expansion at this time. Maybe in the future there will be, but I only look at this time. It did not exist at that time. It was gone. It was written off. It was forgiven. So it was put back in 2 years later, in 2003, for the 2002 tax return, I think. But they filed, I think, late in 2003. I forgot it was April, October 2003. So if it was not there, then wasn't there? Didn't the Vice Chancellor err in considering it if it didn't exist? It's just that simple of an argument. I mean, it simply did not exist. And they were conflicted also because the statute of limitation would have barred any action on this. But, of course, it was in their own self-interest. And they did have a fiduciary duty, as the court found. So, I mean, if you're conflicted, statute precludes it. It's a contrived type of thing that you bring back. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, messy, that the court should have clearly said it's not there, doesn't exist, it didn't exist at the time, and I'm not going to consider it.
Let me try and follow up on that. As I understand it, the Westwood original loan, if it was a loan, was for $2 million, right?
Exactly, yes.
Okay. And that at the point at which it was written off, it was down to a little over $1 million.
Exactly.
Okay, so just for round numbers, let's say $1 million. Okay. That money did actually go into the business, right? The $2 million.
If you believe their position, which they haven't found any paperwork saying that, but we have no reason to frankly. I mean, there's no evidence doubting it.
Okay. So you're complaining about the fact that, as a bookkeeping matter, that contribution, that loan, was written off, and therefore it should not exist anymore. But there were actual dollars that went into the business.
That's true.
And if it wasn't a loan, then those partners made that a contribution of dollars into the business. So why doesn't, one way or another, why doesn't that get accounted for in determining, if not what the asset value is, because you're not reducing it by some loan, but instead saying this is what the capital interests are, the contributions of each of the partners, and it would adjust the percentages. So either way, it has to be accounted for, doesn't it?
Well, no, because they made an intentional decision that they would forego the loan or capital contribution, big shooters alone, and would get the money over here. They made that decision. Now, and that decision would have lasted for eternity if there wasn't for this merger and this evaluation. So they made that decision. They're stuck with that decision.
The decision what, to call it a bad loan?
Right. Illegally, to call it a bad loan, yes. Not that legally makes any difference, but, I mean, it just shows you that they definitively made a decision that they were going to call it a bad loan. There's a second part of that argument that my time's almost up, but I want to address real quick, is that the Chancery Court actually went further than giving them back the 283 that they claimed they were entitled to. The Chancery Court gave them 356, I believe is the figure, 365, 878, by doing a proportional type of thing as a capital contribution, which no one did. I mean, there was not a scintilla of evidence that that was the way to do it. Even in Mr. Wiener's briefs down below, in both of them, both briefs, he asked for only 283. And every single witness, my accountant, their accountant, talked about 283, except their accountant said it should be 25%, but if the court said it should be 22.5%.
So you're saying the trial court made a mathematical error?
No. It gave them more than the evidence indicated they should have been gotten by $44,000, and more than even asked for. I mean, it's an application. The court said, instead of treating it as 283, which everybody said was the number, the court used this proportional thing to say, well, in order to get that amount when you use it as a capital contribution, the way to do it then is for him to, for the trust, to have contributed 365 rather than 283. This proportional thing is application, which I understand what the court did, but I mean, I understand how they got to that number, but there was no basis for that whatsoever.
Mr. Runo, you have just a minute and a half.
I understand. Thank you.
Good morning. If with court's permission, I'd like to take a moment just to start a little bit on valuation to lead into how the court applied it to the trust. We have the benefit, as the court noted, of an experienced appraiser licensed in five different jurisdictions for an independent party, Coors Dates, doing an appraisal in 1997. We refer to it as the Parker appraisal. It's in the appendix. It's several hundred pages of backup data, maybe 150 to 200 pages. It gave the benefit to Mr. Ramuno and Ms. Ryan of a full 10-year lease for Anderson at the time, all 10 years, because it was done in 1997. The lease, actually almost all of the 10 years, the lease didn't commence with rental payments until December of 1997. There aren't future rental payments going beyond December of 2007. We're at the close to the end of the original 10-year lease. Parker did an income and sales. He did both comparisons, income and sales. He had full occupancy as of October 1, 1998, and he calculated everything. He did cash flows, everything, as of October 1, 1998. came up with a figure of $22 million. Now, when Langdon, our expert, looked at that, he increased that by 3% per year from October 1998 to from the day of the end of the appraisal through March 31, 2001. Actually, Mr. Langdon, my expert, was a little bit higher in that approach than their expert because their expert looked at 2% increase in rent and had a combined between 3% value and 2% cash flow. But the court then took the $22 million as of October 1, 1998, which was the effective date of the Parker appraisal, multiplied that, compounded that 3% through March 31, 2001, and came up with $23,711,000. From that, the court added to that all cash and cash equivalents and prepaid expenses. Both accountants agreed to that. That was $1.6 million. Deducted out the 15.889 mortgage balance, principal balance, deducted out $407,000 in accounts payable, and deducted out $111,000 in accrued expenses to get a net of $8.959 million as the equity, the value as of March 31, 2001. Now, Mr. Ramuno complains about his client's capital contribution. The courts took the value, the equity of $8.95 million, and multiplied that by 22.5%. The total trust package came up with a value of $2,015,000, and I'm rounding the numbers off. The total capital contribution from Mr. Romero's client was $2,056,000, 98% of the value. That's 98% of the deficient capital contribution by Mr. Thomas Capano. In an entity, and if you look, it's on page 14 of the pretrial stipulation, it's page B46. This was, let me put it in diplomatic terms, not my client's best investment in the world. In fact, it probably rates, as the testimony was, the worst investment they ever made. Between 1989 and 1998, which includes the first year of the lease, on the tax returns, and it's stipulated, they lost $6.3 million. The drain on this property was $6.3 million. It included, in the year 1992, a loss of $1.1 million. In the year of 1995, a loss of $1.092 million. In 1996, a loss of $1.02 million. At a value of $8.9 million, which is the court's value, all of our clients are deficient in capital contribution. My clients, more than two times, well, each individually, 3.5 times more than what his client is deficient in capital contributions, because the capital contributions as of 2000 were $9.8 million. This entity bled red until 1999. The first year there was any profit for this entity was 1999. They existed for years with capital calls. The capital call in 1992 was $1.8 million. In addition, so the $1 million that came from Westwoods. It didn't get much better. It averaged capital calls of $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 from 93 to 96, and in 1997, $1.69 million, of which Mr. Thomas Capano failed to make his proportion of contribution, and my clients came up with the entire $1.6 million. It's all stipulated in the pretrial stipulation. From the value, the 2.015, 22% value that the court had, it then took 53.78%, which is the share from Mr. Ramuno's client, and came up with a value of $1,084,063, from which it deducted the proportionate share of the capital call that they don't raise in this appeal that Mr. Thomas Capano failed to make in 1997. That was a gross capital call that he failed to make in 1997 of $402,874, when for the failure to make that call, the court increased that to $559,035, taking that $559, multiplying that by the distrust share, 53.78%, there's a reduction in the $1.084 million of $300,000 for Mr. Thomas Campana's failure to make a capital call in 1997. And that gets us to the Westwood. And
wait a second. Is that the $365,000?
No, the Westwoods is slightly different. I think you're referring to the Westwood, and I will get to Westwoods in a moment. Okay. Your Honor is correct on the proportional aspect of Westwood's. And that's the $365,878. And what Mr. Muno has not focused upon, and what I tried perhaps not too articulately to point out in our brief, is that, and Mr. Muno is right, the Vice Chancellor was brighter than Mr. Weiner and my expert and their expert, because our experts just took 2.5% of the $1.2 million. It was the $1 million deficiency of money that was sitting there since 1992 increased on the books and records up to 1.26 in 1996. What the court said is that, basically, taking the $1.26 million as of December 31, 1996, that represents 77.5% because it came from Lewis and Joseph owning 77.5%. If Thomas contributed just the $283,000, that would represent only 18.4%, because that would mean that 81.6% would, well, let me back up. If Thomas contributed $283,000 to $1.26 million, you would have a total in there of $1.543 million. Thomas's $283,000 would only be 18.4% of that number, and our contribution, my client's contribution, would be 81.6%. So the court explained this in a footnote. It's the next to last footnote, I believe, and said, and explained the proportions and how to do the calculations. For my clients to have contributed $1.26 million, which was the number from December 31, that equals 77.5%. You take the $1.26 million, you divide it by 77.5%. Each 1% is equal to $16,261. You multiply the $16,261 times Thomas's 22.5% to come up with 100%, and it's 1.626. 22.5% of 1626 is the 365 number. The court laid it all out in the footnote. Our experts only looked at the gross number. They didn't do the proportional. The court, when the court examined it, came up with the proportional rationale, which is correct, which technically absolutely correct. Vice Chancellor Noble was on top of it more than, say, counsel and experts in the case. As far as the Westwood loans, there's never been any dispute. That money went into original Augustine. That money was reduced to $1,015,000 because there was a escrow of $880,000 that was released when that money came in. That money went back into original Augustine and reduced the $2 million down to $1.015 million. There was some small interest payments paid. There's a ledger sheet from the original Augustine's books as one of the exhibits, one of the pages in the appendix that shows how penny for penny it got reduced down to $1.15 million. That money sits there today. That money has never come out. The record is undisputed that my clients used post-tax dollars to get that money in, into original Augustine. What they did is they had another development, and as lots sold, the bank took out the money per lot on a per lot basis. That's post-tax dollars from each closing to pay off the balance of $1.15 million. No one, Mr. Romuno never looks at the fact that they needed to earn and have $1.6 million before tax and paid $600,000 in taxes on that before they got down to the $1 million that they left in Augustine. Because they paid taxes going in. When they got the money, they didn't get the money out. What they got out was a short-term capital loss. And for purposes of the trial, we assumed that it was 40% or 100% deductible on a short-term capital loss, that they used up every single penny as soon as they could on that. It's still less. 40% or whatever they paid on the 1.2 that they got back is $100,000 less than 40% on 1.6. So they recouped and set off the taxes they'd already paid on the money to put in, the money that they had put in. But you're taking us, we're all going to a step that's twice removed from the original transaction. And the court cut through all that and focused on the fact that there's $1 million that has been sitting in this entity from December of 1992 that, according to, and the accountant that suggested it should have been a capital contribution instead of a short non-collectible debt, that it should have been, because it was related parties, a capital contribution and booked as a capital contribution. What was done in 1996, it was offset against the value of the land. So if the land was valued at $5 million, the land was reduced to $4 million. Short-term capital loss was generated from that.
Well, which, apart from the label, is the bottom line any different?
No, the bottom line is $1 million cash sitting in this entity that my two of my clients contributed, that Mr. Thomas Capano didn't contribute from 1992. And when it came time to cash out Thomas Capano, fairness dictated that there be some accounting of that. And the court took the accounting of that, and the only thing we took the cross appeal on is the court only ran us with some type of interest through December 31, 1996, and didn't, in consistency, run an interest rate at 7% from January 1, 1997 to March 21, 2001. That's the only aspect that wasn't evened up as of 2001. And that was the only thing we took the cross appeal on. I think it's two pages in my answering brief. And that was the only inconsistency. But the dollars are in this entity. The dollars have never come out. Mr. Romero argues about tangential tax consequences that even when argued means that my clients still experience the loss because they put post-tax dollars in to pay off this, to carry the business to the benefit of his client. So the $1 million is still sitting there.
With the loan reappearing on the books, does the record reflect whether amended tax returns were filed?
An amended tax return was not filed for 1996, but it reappeared on the books as a debt. When and if that debt is paid off, my clients will be paying on that debt. I mean, there'll be tax consequences because of the capital loss they took in 1996. And it's undisputed that there will be tax consequences for my clients when that is repaid to Westwood and passed through them. Because it was put back on in 2002 as a debt back on the books and records. But Mr. Romero argues that it should have been paid off in 1996 or 1997.
Just so I understand, the tax consequence of getting payment on the loan after it's been written off is that it then becomes income. Is that right?
That would be correct. But it wasn't passed through as a write-off. Mr. Romero's wrong. The record is clear. It was passed out as a short-term capital loss. If it was passed off as if it was forgiven, it would have been $1 million of income to Augustine. Because the moment it's forgiven, it should have been, in that theory, $1 million worth of income because it's for debt forgiveness. So they adjusted the basis for the land, and it's in the record in our brief, and the pass out was a short-term capital loss for that. And the record is undisputed below that when that is paid back, there will be tax consequences to my clients because they took the capital losses in the 1996, 1997, or whenever after that. And they will have tax consequences when that comes out. But the essence of the court below said he's going to go with what the accountant said. He's going to treat it as a capital contribution because there's $1,015,000 that went into original Augustine that's been in there since December of 1992 that came from Joseph and Joe and Lewis, and nothing came in from Tom. So when Tom's being bought out, he's taking into account. And he took into proportionally exactly the amount to put Tom in his 22.5%. And when he did that, he came up with $365,000, which was $80,000 higher than our number. Now, Mr. Romero didn't pay all of the $365,000. Mr. Romero was assessed $196,000 because he only had 53.78% of the $365,000. So it's... And that's the entire Westwoods. The $1 million is there. It's been there. It's never gone out. It's never got paid out to my clients. The money's been there since December of 1992. And as far as the money ever going in, we have prior transfers on all these things. We have mirror image books and entries on both. Same accountants, mirror images, books, and records from 92 to 96. Ledger sheet showing interest accruing. The last aspect is development. Mr. Romero didn't address this issue, so... I don't think he intends to do so in rebuttal, and I've addressed the two issues he's addressed before your honors. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lee has not discussed with you, and what is wrong with this Westwood approach is the fact that this was a debt. And if Westwood had not been the Joseph and Lewis's entity, and had been a separate entity over here, then all three of them, Joseph, Lewis, and Tom, would have all paid something to Westwood. And that figure that was owed was 1,260,247 dollars. Now, because Westwood is gone, it's defunct, it's gone, no reason why they shouldn't be getting anything, because it was clearly a debt. I mean, he's treated as a debt. Everybody treated as a debt. Because the court then treats it as capital contribution, Westwood over here, instead of getting 1.260, gets 1.626125, approximately the $385,000 or $400,000 more, almost $385,000 more. Now, there cannot be any equity, any fairness, any logic for giving Westwood over here a debt $385,000 more than they're entitled to, simply because the court says, well, we'll treat it as a capital contribution, and thereby, using this proportionate thing, we have to increase it up to 1.6. There's just no logic to that. Now, Mr. Weiner says, well, Vice Chancellor Noble was brighter than all of us. And I'm sure that's true, but that doesn't mean that because he's brighter than all of us, he can just ignore the evidence and say, okay, I'm going to give him $400,000 more, because it's a way to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Romero.
Very good.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.